Brethren and sisters, we welcome you to the podcast and hope you will find joy in listening to the infants this day. Those of you who are here to listen for your own edification, good on you. For those here listening on behalf of deceased persons, what the hell are you thinking? They're dead. They can't hear a damn thing. Or can they? Brethren and sisters, if you are true and faithful to the things you hear in today's episode, the day will come when you probably will rule over everyone, because that's just how we roll. The realization of these blessings is dependent on your ability to stomach the contents of this episode and listen to it all the way to the end and believe everything you hear and be indoctrinated by the infants, placing their scatterbrained thoughts and opinions above all else. Or else, for the infants shall not be mocked, except when they do it to themselves or when it happens without consequence in any other way. If any of you desire to withdraw rather than press onward with this episode and accept these things of your own free will and choice, then just stop the episode. I mean, it's pretty easy. You just press stop. No one's holding a gun to your head. That is all. And now, our new scientific mythology.
Scientific mythology.
About 13.5 billion years ago, matter, energy, time, and space came into being in what is known as the Big Bang. The story of these fundamental features of our universe is called physics. About 300,000 years after their appearance, matter and energy started to coalesce into complex structures called atoms, which then combined into molecules. The story of atoms, molecules, and their interactions is called chemistry. About 3.8 billion years ago, on a planet called Earth, certain molecules combined to form particularly large and intricate structures called organisms. The story of organisms is called biology. About 70,000 years ago, organisms belonging to the species Homo sapiens started to form even more elaborate structures called cultures. The subsequent development of these human cultures is called history.
There's an old saying in Tennessee, I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, we can't get fooled again.
Three important revolutions shaped the course of history. The cognitive revolution kickstarted history about 70,000 years ago. The agricultural revolution sped it up about 12,000 years ago. The scientific revolution, which got underway only 500 years ago, may well end history and start something completely different. This book tells the story of how these three revolutions have affected humans and their fellow organisms.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the Quorum.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Oslin, and this is part two of our discussion of the book Sapiens. Now, this is also the last episode of 2017, so let's pause to congratulate our patron of the month for December 2017, which is, drumroll, Trent Rolfe. Rolfe? Did I pronounce it right, Trent? Trent is a $1 per episode supporter with no set limit, and we released 5 Patreon-supported episodes in December, so Trent wins a reverse tithing prize of $50. Thank you, Trent. Merry, happy holidays, Trent, and thank you for your support on Patreon. Now, before I get you back to the panel discussion, actually, you know what? Let's just go right to the panel discussion, and then all of this monologuing that I'm doing will be a really long, extended Easter egg for anybody who wants to hear it. But for those who are just here for the panel discussion, you don't have to be held hostage to hear me lecture you. So let's go right to the panel discussion, and then there will be a long Easter egg with this episode. Happy New Year.
Heather, wait, I just want to explain how I'm hearing you and why I think slightly different and why I think this is a silly argument. We should move on. But based on your metaphor with the moon and the distance, I'm not disputing that the distance to the moon is not an objective fact. But the moon, the word, the fact that we're using that word, our idea of what the moon is, what it looks like, our ability to compute mathematics, not the independent truth of mathematics, but the numbers that we're using, a base 10 system, you yourself said we would have to agree on the math. That is a myth in the definition of the author of this book, because it's agreed upon story that we can both interpret and we can both communicate with each other based on that agreed upon myth.
I'm really glad you brought up base 10. Yeah.
I agree with everything but the use of the word myth there, Andrew. Everything but the use of the word myth.
Then it's just a semantic difference. I mean, this is a purely semantic difference.
And I certainly wouldn't mind moving on.
Okay. All right.
That was awesome.
I mean, if
though,
it's really
Andrew.
Just one word, then let's just leave it.
It reminded me when he talks about Babylon and he's talking about how they used a base 6 counting system as well as a base 10, and that we still have survivals of that base 6 in our 24-hour periods and things like that. That's a good illustration of the mythic elements of culture.
Okay, and I agree with that. Like whatever you want, however you want to divide things, and whatever you want to call them. That is mythological, sure. But the underlying fact of like the speed of light, however, whatever base 10 or base 6, however you want to express it is fine, whether or not you even understand each other. But the fact of the speed of light is not up for debate.
Until scientists find something else, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it might be different in different universes.
Yeah.
All right. So what do we got here? Next question. So how is the flood of man in the flood in Sapiens similar to the flood of Noah in the Bible? So this was when Homo sapiens broke out of their starting place and overtook the world. I found this part really kind of, it's hard to read. Hard to read about all those poor species that we just annihilated.
Spoiler alert, all the sloths die.
Yes.
Yeah. Hey, John. I don't know. I keep referring to you to speak for the apologists, just because you've been swimming in those waters for so goddamn long. I don't see a way for Mormons to get out of a literal interpretation of the flood, just simply because of the Book of Mormon and the Jaredites. Do apologists try to say, because you said that they say the Adam and Eve story is just a myth. Do they do the same thing with the flood, or do they actually try to find cherry pick evidence for a global flood?
I think these days it's all about plausible deniability. It's just all about reducing the target so small that any possible explanation, could allow someone to maintain belief. And I think that, you know, I really like what Jonathan Haidt has to say, that we arrive at our conclusions emotionally and then use logic to justify those conclusions. And I don't think the average Mormon or the average apologist care about the logical connections between reality and science and their beliefs. I just think it's working for them. And if they can just say that Hugh Nibley guy, he was a smart PhD from Berkeley. If he believed it, I'm good with it too. I think that's about as much rigor as most Mormons will ever pass through.
So you'd say the majority of card-carrying Mormons, especially in the Morador, believe it's historical fact. that the earth was globally flooded.
No, I'm saying they don't care about any of the questions we're asking.
Yeah. I think you're right. Well,
but you
I'm
didn't.
That's why you left, because you actually you cared.
I mean, you didn't until like a certain point in your life, though. I mean, it wasn't until like you had all the information to doubt the flood narrative when you were 15.
Yeah, it was pretty not believable story. Even for a 15-year-old.
I mean, like, but you didn't until a different point. And it's because, like John was saying, it's an emotional disconnect that allows you to view it through this different lens, through this different myth.
Yeah.
There you go. I was looking for I needed a little look up from Glenn. All right.
The myth that the flood didn't happen. Yeah. That's a binding myth, man. We should build a religion around it.
Mm. Well, he also talks about the importance of cognitive dissonance as a coping mechanism, that it's universal among our species, that people were able to hold in their mind both the tenets of honor culture and chivalry, as well as, you know, humble Christ-like virtues, and still go about their daily lives, like alternating back and forth between the two. Like people are able, like my boyfriend at Harvard, who was able to go and get A's in his biology classes at Harvard and still believe in the literal interpretation of the biblical creation. And I remember somebody else asking me about, well, why would God, you know, make the earth with those records of dinosaurs in it? And me having the exact response that John talks about, being like, I don't know, and I don't care. What do you care about that? It's not important.
It's not pertinent to my salvation, was what we used to say.
That's exactly
so
right.
So are you using that to illustrate cognitive dissonance?
Yeah, so cognitive dissonance. Yeah. You may have this, you may recognize that the flood of Noah is extraordinarily implausible to the point of being just crazy.
So you just dismiss it.
But but at the same time, believing that it's gotta in some way be true.
Oh, right. So you're okay.
So you just hold both of those dissonant ideas in your brain.
And we all do that. All humans do that all the time. We all hold contradictory beliefs.
What I thought was interesting about the way he talked about cognitive dissonance, and I think I like this about most of what he did in the book. He kind of has this style where he wants to turn everything on its head and say, how does it look like from this perspective? You know, where typically when, at least when I've heard about cognitive dissonance, it's like, it's another kind of us versus them thing. Like they've got cognitive dissonance, but I don't, you know, like cognitive dissonance is a bad thing. And he's saying if like cognitive dissonance was an absolutely necessary thing, without cognitive dissonance, people wouldn't be able to believe so stridently in their fictions. And that's what allows people to cooperate and allows progress. And so, you know, we should look at cognitive dissonance a little bit differently instead of trying to cure the world of it, appreciate it for what it's done. I liked that.
I liked that too. And I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because it reminded me very much of the way in which he describes tribalism and how my kind of, my attitude towards tribalism was changed by the book a little bit, because as liberals, we diss tribalism all the time. Oh, those horrible tribalists, that's the worst. People who care about their in-group, they're so bad. It's such a character flaw. But actually, humans evolved to function primarily in small bands of fewer than 150 people. And we thrive when we care, when we're closer to our intimates and care more about our family and friends than other people. It's actually really important for the happiness of humans to have close bonds, even though they probably shouldn't care about their own kids more than they do about children that they've never met in, you know, Ethiopia, if you're a strict utilitarian. So did you guys come away? I'm kind of interested to hear what Randy thinks about tribalism, because I don't know if he was swayed by that.
Well, I think, tribalism gone awry is a dangerous thing. I think that we all like to be around people that are like-minded. And so, you know, we're going to gravitate towards people that think the same way. But I'm trying to think this article I read. And it was based on Jonathan Haidt's work too, where like it was part of my presentation where the right has gone farther to the right than and the left has gone left, but not as far to the left as the right has gone right. And part of the right going as far right as it has is because it's become more tribal. It's become more, right and wrong, and compromise is a sin. You can't compromise your values. Whereas in the old days, Democrats and Republicans would get in the same room together, realizing they come from different places, but they have shared values and they try to come to a common ground. Now they're not even coming into the same arena, in large part because the right has gone so far to the right that compromise isn't something that they're allowed to do anymore, or they get primaried out. And so tribalism, I don't know, like, I think that when you go to the left, you're less prone to tribalism. You still get it. You still get those Bernie or Buster tribalists that are ideological purists, but it's still more of a herding cats kind of thing. A lot of the same that you get with atheists. Maybe because atheists don't have a binding myth. They have a narrative in evolution, but that's not very inspiring.
Yeah, they don't have a binding myth.
Well, it's not as strong as something that, you know, that you're willing to, you know, fight and die for. I don't know. I guess your question is, do I think I'm as tribal as Republicans?
No. I mean, did you see any value into tribalism? Because I've only ever heard you use it as a slur word.
We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for, you know, tribalism.
Okay, good. I'm glad you can admit that.
There's an evolution from the hunter-gatherer, kinships to the city-states, to the empires. The circle, like you said, the circle, we evolved in the circle of kinships that are 150.
Who can hear John Hamer right now singing the Circle of Life? Is that the first thing that came? Like, and every time you said circle, I was just like waiting for Hamer to jump in.
The problem that we have is that, like Heather said, we evolved to be in these circles where we can only know like a group of maybe up to 150. And our brain hasn't changed much since then. But the circles kept getting bigger, and it's so hard to fight the instinct of us versus them. It's in all of us. It's what allowed us to get to where we are today. But at the same time, it's something that we need to be careful. Again, just like Glenn is really, vigilant about his arrogance, because he should be, we all as humans should be vigilant about
Glenn's arrogance. Oh,
no, our tribalism is
I hoisted myself on that petard. That's fine. You can do it.
The more stories you tell about yourself in the past, the more arrogant I think you are, innately. So, geez, that was a joke.
All just laughed, just not at the right time.
So I wasn't really reading into the debate about whether or not tribalism is good or bad, but I read this book with a Mormon lens given this podcast, and I thought his description of tribalism, what tribalism is, how it evolves, there's not a better description of the evolution of the modern Mormon church in his definition of tribalism. And specifically this definition of 150, which I'm sure you've discussed before, but that's about how many active members you have in a Mormon ward today. Even if the ward lists 300 or 400, I was in church on Sunday, don't tell anybody, but I did an active count. It was the primary program, and there were 160 people in that chapel on Sunday. And this is in Utah Valley. So I think there's something there. And specifically the origin of that number in that group is human language. And he says specifically that it's gossip. It's our ability to gossip about each other that helps us form a tribe. And again, I can't think of a better description of Mormonism than a religion that's founded on gossip.
150 people gossiping.
That's awesome.
Yes. That's brilliant.
Yes, Andrew.
It's the ceiling on the shit talking.
Yeah, and the lay ministry thing is the thing that we always love to pump and pimp as members, that we don't pay our ministry. But really what that creates is this tribe where social standing is everything and gossip is social currency within that small group. And that's how it was with hunter-gatherer tribes. That's really interesting, Andrew. You have wards, which are little mini tribes, all in a bigger circle of a common myth that unites a bunch of these little tribes. That's why it works so goddamn well.
Mm-hmm. And
brilliant.
And wards do have their own culture. Even in our stake, there are very different cultures in different wards in those 150 group bands. Yeah, that's great. So I was remembering, John, one of the things that you posted to Facebook from Sapiens was about horses in the Americas. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. Do you have that quote or just tell us like the gist of it? It's like, if we read a history book about Italians eating spaghetti, right? Or something like that. What was it?
Yeah. We wouldn't. I'm frankly trying to look up the photo that I shared, but yeah, I mean, if we, he basically just takes a big shot at the idea that there were horses, you know, in Mesoamerica during the time of the Book of Mormon. And he's not thinking of Mormonism, but it's just obvious to everyone else what reality is. And I think I said something to the effect of, if we've got Julius Caesar eating spaghetti when pasta was, I don't know, invented in China or something, we would obviously know that whatever book we were reading was false and was a fraud. And yet with the Book of Mormon, we find a million ways, including calling tapers horses, to be able to still hold to the book.
Oh yes. I read something on an apologist website today as I was looking at this. So he talks about, so humans came across to North America, just so you know, this is what the science shows. This isn't what happened in the Book of Mormon. Humans come across the land bridge about 16,000 years ago. They don't get very far because of the glaciers. They hang out till about 12,000. Then they come further down. There are horses, camels, lions in the Americas. They kill them all. They're all dead. And then they're reintroduced by the Spanish in the 15th century. Right?
Well, I mean, if you believe in that narrative.
Right, if you have to believe in that. But this apologist website is like, yeah, so the Book of Mormon says horses and chariots, like go prepare my horses and chariots to conduct me into the land. But it never says the horses drove the chariots. They could have just been walking alongside.
Just hanging out.
Yeah, just you just like go.
Big old dogs.
Riding on in the taper box and the horse box on top of the chariot that's pulled by humans.
What about the Kirloms and Cumoms? What happened to them? Did they die out with the Diprotodons?
I'm gonna say, given the Homo sapiens history of genocide of animal species, yeah, probably.
So yeah, just to throw this left hook in there, what if you were like an aspiring BYU graduate student and your proposal for paleontology research was to like go dig up Kirloms in Montana?
Can you still get funded? I don't know if you can anymore. I think you really could in the 60s, 70s.
Has anyone, as an apostle or a prophet, defined a Kirlom and a Cumom? I've only heard conjecture that they might have been woolly mammoths or some other. All it says is that which were very useful animals. That's all it says in the Book of Mormon.
What do the real scientists say, John?
About what?
About Kirloms, Cumoloms.
So basically, John just represents like every mentality of every person that's not actually on any subset of the
He's
population that's not here.
No, this is, I swear, I did a book club on Sapiens here in Salt Lake City. If you guys have heard of WACA, Women of a Certain Age, there are these other social groups in Salt Lake There's one called COCA, which is couples of a certain age. And then there's MOCA, which is men of a certain age. And MOCA has been having book clubs, and MOCA did a book club on Sapiens. And I was so stunned how amazing this book is. Yeah, I thought about the myth thing as it relates to Mormons, but really mostly I was just stunned by the beautiful human race and all the amazing science in this book. And I swear to bejeebus that it wasn't 5 minutes into a conversation about Sapiens where we were talking about Joseph Smith and Fanny Alger and Kirtland, you know, and I'm like, we are so like brain warped that we've got this beautiful book here, all this amazing science, and we've got to tie everything back to Mormonism. It just shows how traumatic our experiences were. We all have PTSD.
Yeah, I had I had the same exact reaction Glenn did reading the book. Like, that book makes you zoom out so far out from the human history that it, like, Mormonism isn't even a dot anymore.
Debating Book of Mormon history is like debating whether elves could beat the dwarves in Middle Earth.
They totally could, by the way.
You realize there are serious, very serious groups of people who are doing just that.
Uh-huh.
But it does feel like it's so, I mean, even the way they start the first like five sentences, I was like, oh my God, this is like really contextualizing everything. When it's like matter started, you know, when the Big Bang started, then it's physics, and then like eventually got to chemistry, and then eventually gets to biology, and then like in this last tiny blip, it's history. Although I was surprised by, even though I do not subscribe to the idea of a God, I was overwhelmed. I felt like when he talked about that first chapter of Animals of No Great Significance, where he talks about humans as just one of the animal kingdom, an otherwise insignificant species. In a way, I felt like I was like drowning. Like he was just like filling up every corner of my psyche where I held out like this sense of uniqueness and specialness, and was just like systematically just smashing them all. And I didn't realize that I had all of these latent, I don't know. I mean, I guess they're technically egotistical, but
the Sapien sense supremacist.
Of self-worth. Yeah, right. The sense of self-worth is tied to the singularity of man. I didn't realize that I held all of those until I read this book. And it was difficult to work through.
Do you know the follow-up to Sapiens, Homo Deus?
I saw it on like the recommended list. I'm planning on reading it, but I haven't read it yet.
Okay.
Is it worse?
No, it's awesome. No, it's
not worse. I mean, it's a great book, but you know.
No, but like when he's projecting forward, to me, there's even more parallels with like Mormon theology in that, because he's basically saying that the endpoint of evolution is some kind of hybrid artificial intelligence with inorganic material. And it's going to be, you know, like whatever came before Homo sapiens, the difference to Homo sapiens, Homo Deus is the next. I mean, it's really, really trippy and very, very fascinating.
Are you singing Homo Deus, Homo Deus?
Yeah, right.
Homo Deus,
right.
Homo Deus. Right.
Rock me, Homo Deus.
Rock me, Homo Deus, yeah.
But it also made me think of, though, that there's like a trope within science fiction when they talk about artificial intelligence, that where they say like, oh, well, eventually something gets to a point where it's so smart that it makes rational decisions. And the thing that I got from this book is like intelligence has nothing to do with rationality at all. That you can be as smart. I mean, even
humans, rationality is based on a fiction. It's based on congruity with fictions. That's what logic is, right?
But even if you say like the fiction of projecting out, okay, what's really feasible given the, you know, population growth that we have at this particular time and what we're doing and the resources that we're using up, like we're not making like smart decisions, even though we have the ability to exploit resources in a way that was inconceivable to that's inconceivable to any other species. Like, we're not necessarily using those powers to even for our own long-term good. Like, what's the equivalent of an artificial intelligence's, like, what's the AI equivalent of an obesity epidemic?
I'm not tracking with you anymore.
So the obesity epidemic is a hijacking of like this evolutionary kind of deep source level code where it's just like just intake calories, just as fat, like the highest concentration of calories that you can intake at a given time, just do it, just eat it all, right? And that's where the obesity epidemic comes, is we actually now we have access to unlimited or practically unlimited calories, and our brains are just telling us just consume all of it as fast as you can. And it ends up actually killing us faster than if we didn't do that. So I'm saying that even though we have the ability to, even though like super intelligence doesn't mean that you make good decisions for yourself.
So are you projecting forward and you're asking like artificial intelligence, what would their, like the obesity epidemic in humans is a survival of the way that we've evolved.
Right.
Right.
But it's not well suited to our current, like,
right. So like an artificial intelligence that is consciousness that's created by humans in on a machine didn't evolve. So they're not going to have those instincts to them through. They're actually programmed by a person, not programmed by nature and through evolution, through millennia of choices.
But it's a similar thing where programmed by nature means that the programming that we receive from nature was according to whatever the input, whatever the optimization function was at that time of how do you ensure your own thing, right? And it could be irrelevant to your current situation.
So
in the same way that like we can create an artificial intelligence whose optimization function isn't necessarily well suited to its own survival, and it could end up, you know, destroying itself and everything else in the process, just trying to figure out what the fuck it's doing.
Right.
Yeah. Sure. That's like the paperclip monster, right? So we could create an AI and say, make me some paperclips. And so it tries to optimize that function and decides that the best thing in the world to do is kill all humans and use all energy and resources to make the most paperclips possible, even though that doesn't make me more paperclips. Right.
Yeah.
So it's fulfilling its original programming, but in a completely irrational way.
What was the Rick and Morty one? You passed the salt, or you passed the butter? You passed the butter.
What is my purpose?
What is my purpose? You passed the butter.
Welcome to my world, pal. So, Jake, did it break down your ideas of humans' life being more valuable than other life enough where if you saw like a child drowning and a dog drowning, it would be a tough decision which one to save?
No.
But it did make you think about it. Like, why, you know, it is a construct. Humanism is a construct. And
right.
That's one of my tribes that I belong to that, like, I felt the same thing. I felt like I was drowning too. Like, you know, what does anything mean anything? You know?
Right.
Is there any way to find meaning in life? Everything's a construct.
Well, I belong to the dog tribe, just so you know.
You'd save the dog?
You'd save the dog.
You said the dog.
I'd go after the dog. Yeah. But Jake, I thought it was interesting you were talking about this differential between what's rational and what's intelligent, because that actually brings us to the next point in Heather's structure, because wasn't that his point about the agricultural revolution? That it wasn't necessarily an intelligent thing to do, but it was the rational response.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And I am sorry, John, if I've got you here under false pretenses and you were hoping we were going to talk about this book without relating it to Mormonism.
No. Listen, this is all I do is talk about Mormonism. I'm just saying, aren't we all broken? Aren't we all irretrievably broken? That's all I'm saying.
You are right about that. But this one actually is fairly independent of our faith tradition. So what did you guys think about this romantic, and I already tip my hand in here when I call it romantic, this romantic portrayal of the pre-agricultural forager society. Did you buy it? Does it sound like the good old days? Is everybody ready to rip off their clothes and go hunt and gather?
No, but it made me appreciate just the unbelievable and incalculable human suffering that led through that transition to get me to my iPhone and mm-hmm. my laptop.
For people who haven't read it, can you sum up how life changed or for society with the agricultural revolution?
Well, by accident, wheat is a wild grass that flourished in the Mesopotamian area. And actually, my favorite line in the book is, "We didn't domesticate wheat; wheat domesticated us."
We didn't land awesome. On wheat; yeah. We landed on us.
Right, and so you get a couple of people, capitalizing on wheat and domesticating it. And it's not like it all happened all at once. It was like it just slowly happened over many thousands of years. And eventually, over time, hunter-gatherers territory kind of got pushed out. And farmers, if hunter-gatherers had a famine or a drought or something, they would just move to a different place. If you're a farmer, you've invested too much in that land to move. And then after a certain amount of generations, you can't like go back to hunter gathering because you've forgotten that you don't have any like memory of any other way to live. Mm-hmm. And then over time, what happens is you have a more efficient way per acre of producing calories, but you lose the variety in your diet. And then you start to accumulate a lot of excess grain that can then be abused by a smaller ruling class. And then boom, there you are, with these agriculture-based city-states. And the hunter-gatherers slowly just kind of got pushed off to the side anywhere that happened. Anyway.
Yeah, I remember him talking about like them having hunter-gatherers having a shorter work week, working fewer hours, and having more varied lives than your average water carrier, peasant, or factory worker, and having more free time, having a better diet because it was more a bit more nutrients and they had evolved to subsist on that kind of a diet. So seems like, yeah, a lot of things they gave up thinking, if I just work a little harder at this agriculture, I'll have more. It'll be more of a certain thing, even though he claimed that it was a less certain thing. Because once you become dependent on a particular crop, then
you're highly vulnerable.
You're highly vulnerable, right. Potato famine destroys Ireland. Whereas a potato famine for foragers, if they couldn't find potatoes, they'd go eat wild onions or something.
Yeah, and it also put people in higher density populations where they could get more disease. So life expectancies dropped, brain size dropped because of lack of nutrition. But it was this; it was passing through this veil of tears that led us to get to modernity.
So. That's interesting you say that brains shrank because of nutritional changes, because he makes a couple of arguments in there that human brains may have been shrinking because forager society required more generalized knowledge, required you to know more about the world that you lived in, and agricultural society required just specialized knowledge, required you to know less. So you didn't need as big of a brain. And also he makes this kind of vicious way of saying it, that like agriculture, which was easy, made it possible for low quality genes to survive and propagate. Only the genes of the smartest and the most skilled foragers were passed on.
Yeah. Well, if you were like a very low intelligent person in hunter-gatherer society, you'd probably walk off a cliff or get eaten by an animal. And you weren't before you got to reproductive age. Whereas it now, everyone's unspectacular genes are free to become the paterfamilias and produce many, many offspring.
I slightly disagree with his depiction, and I realize why he did it. He's turning, you know, our general ideas on its head, and he's surprising us, and we're like, oh wow, this is very opposite kind of how we would explain this logically to other people. But I think it's oversimplified, which these books always run the risk of doing because it's a popular explanation of pretty heady concepts. But I lived as a hunter-gatherer on a few different occasions, and I can say that it's really hard work. It's much harder than he depicted, because he talks about them only working a certain number of hours during the day. And in my very brief instant being a forager, what I found was that you are economizing calories all the time, because you can choose to go out and look for food, but you're going to be burning energy. And especially if you're in a hot place, you don't want to burn energy that you can't replenish. So it's, you're not working less hours because life is easy, but because you have to conserve energy. And finding enough food to keep yourself full for a day is very hard work.
Well, maybe it's because you weren't hunting mammoths.
Well, I didn't,
or you didn't have a tribe of 150.
I didn't have a tribe. I was alone. If I'd had a tribe, if you had been there, you could have created a diversion and I would have killed the mammoth.
Wow. What, man.
So, I would have been killed.
I think the original question, which obviously you asked facetiously, like, is there any way to, you know, rip off their clothes and become a hunter-gatherer? Like, there's no going back, right? We don't have goals to be a shitty hunter-gatherer. I wouldn't make it very hard. I'd make it about as long as it took for my glasses to fall off and break, and then I would be dead. So, it's kind of, in some ways, I mean, I think he makes a compelling argument for, you know, in terms of describing it like a Ponzi scheme that we're all kind of, now we're too far invested in and we can't pull ourselves out and you can't go back. But, you know, at the same time, like, how it's all relative to your experience. Like, everything is, I'm used to being, you know, between 72 and 77 degrees 90% of the time. So, like, if I'm not like that, I'm like, ugh, I don't like this. This is gross. It's too hot. It's too cold.
Isn't he also intentionally trying to create a parallel to the environment that we're in today? And,
yes.
You know, saying that, you know, there is these three great revolutions in the history of Homo sapiens. And here we're talking about the agricultural revolution and that we're in the midst of one right now, and that there's going to be benefits that come from it, but there's also going to be, things that we lose, that we never get back. And so I feel like that kind of biased the way that he was telling that story.
I remember him connecting it to consumerism, which is this myth that sounds really great, that if you just work a little harder, then you'll earn a little more, you'll have a few more things, be able to do a few more things, and that will make you a little happier. All of which is true except the last part. But it's almost impossible to resist the seeming logic of it. And I haven't done the experiment that Andrew did and try living as a hunter-gatherer, but have you guys seen this documentary called First Contact?
Anybody? Oh, the documentary with Jodie Foster?
No.
It's pretty great. There's another documentary I saw recently.
Oh, that was just Contact.
Sharknado.
Sharknado.
It's a great documentary. It's very rigorous.
Sounds like my kind of thing. All right, so you all must go now. You must just show your nerd cred and go watch this documentary because it's so good. So it's about the first contact with forager tribes in the Amazon. And cool. So these are people who are still living in that culture. They have no clothes. They have only a few tools. Their shelters are really exposing them to the elements. Their foraging lands are always constantly being shrunken by other groups coming in. So they're always in, is your microphone still on there, Glenn?
Every time Glenn shifts, we all go,
Really?
Yeah, I think so. So anyway, they're always in conflict with the rival bands over short resources, and they're, as soon as they're contacted, they're fascinated with clothes. They want clothes so badly, they'll go and they'll kill people, they'll steal clothes, and then half of them die from fevers because the clothes had, you know, bacteria or viruses on them. This one tribe they contact can't count past 10. They have no concept of 11 or anything above that. They only count, you know, to 10. And so they ask some of the people who are going out, like the scientists, the anthropologists who are going out and contacting them, shouldn't we be preserving their culture? Because they're not supposed to contact them. It's against the laws of the government there. And he's like, why? We should bring them into modernity. What are we supposed to do? Just let them run around singing and dancing. And he's like making fun of them kind of. And so they then talk to some of the primitive tribes that have been introduced to modernity and have learned the language. And they're like, no, it was terrible. It was terrible when we were hunter gatherers. We're getting killed all the time. We're always getting rained on and people are getting sick and dying. It's so much better now. So I do sort of think, like Andrew said, that it's kind of a trendy thing to say, oh, the agricultural revolution was so bad. The foraging society was the good old days.
It felt like he was romanticizing it a little bit too much to me.
There was a part of that that, and I don't have the details in front of me, so I don't know if any of you have this to help me out here, but he said something about that different groups of Homo sapiens across the world in roughly the same period of time, and I don't know how many span of years or decades or whatever we're talking about, but that the agricultural revolution happened everywhere basically around the same time without contact from other sapiens. And that, to me, that begs the question of why, like what happened, that there was something that happened. How did that happen?
That is really intriguing. Yeah. I remember it being within the span of a few thousand years that different cultures did develop agriculture,
and they all figured it out independently of one another, and they figured out in pretty much the same types of ways.
I think it was because I think you mentioned it being at the end of the last ice age, right? When conditions were favorable.
That's correct, because then they could grow more wheat.
Yeah. Otherwise, the church is true, right?
I don't know about the church being true, but it just makes me wonder if they're. There has been contact from other, you know, so the documentary that you're talking about, First Contact, where you've got these archaeologists that have a different perspective, should we allow them to stay in modernity or lift them out of it? Did we have some brothers and sisters from the stars that came and saw us and gave us a lift?
Do you think we could have figured out how to grow wheat on our own? I think that's really demeaning.
Every place in the world, they figured out that's a pretty big jump,
and not every place.
Well, and it wasn't like the same day.
I'm just asking a question. I'm not saying that it did.
Well, it gave me a woo woo feeling when you said it. I kind of felt the spirit when you brought that point up.
And it wasn't just wheat. It was corn in the Americas. It was rice. Wheat in Mesopotamia and rice in Asia.
So, but if you do get this perspective, you know, where you're looking at all of this earth, you know, like the millions and millions of years. And we're saying that if his next book is correct and there is going to be evolution to a Homo Deus type, is it so strange to think that maybe that's happened before and this isn't the first time that it's happened and that it could? Like, it opens up those possibilities for me in ways that I'm less likely to just jump on the mocking train when something like that happens and goes, well, I guess maybe there could be. Scott told me no. I talked to Scott about this over the weekend and he said, no, it's impossible because of the speed of light. It's all, you can't travel that distance in any way. But
yeah,
it would be highly unlikely for a living organism to make it we'd have to solve interstellar travel. Which is difficult for given the lifespan of man. So we'd first have to solve death.
So and that's addressed in Homo Deus.
Are you seriously asking if we've been visited by aliens who gave us agricultural technology? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Isn't there a possibility that could be an explanation for why this happened?
Anything's possible, but that's incredibly remote.
I'm on the wrong podcast. Is this Alex Jones?
I know. What the fuck are you talking about, man?
Aliens.
Sorry, Randy. Those are the kinds of things I think about when I read a book like this.
I didn't think about aliens. I always think about Mormons. Since I'm bringing the Mormon tonight, I thought it was very interesting that he juxtaposed these two societies, the foragers with the agricultural revolutionists, because I wonder if our species to this day were uncomfortable with this dichotomy and what we sacrificed. And this is not part of our own genetic memory and regret. Because when we look at our own creation myths or civilization myths in Mormonism, when we compare the Lamanites and the Nephites, they were constantly swapping roles in the Book of Mormon. And that same ideology about Lamanites, about native peoples, continues to this day. So when you look at Lamanites, in some ways they're castigated as these kind of very uncivilized foragers that should be pitied. And on the flip side, they're often kind of put on a pedestal as the noble savage, which is what European civilization did to the rest of the world. And I think there's not really a right or wrong answer here. We're uncomfortable with our own evolution.
I think you see that in the Cain and Abel myth. And that was the next question that you had on here, Heather, that, mm-hmm. that if you do take that position that you stated there, Andrew, that there's some kind of genetic memory or that we lament the shift from a hunter-gatherer society to an agricultural society and all of the potential problems that brought. The Cain and Abel story, Cain represents agriculture. He's the farmer. He's the tiller of the ground. And Abel actually, I mean, it's still domesticated animals, but it's still animals. And when they're commanded to sacrifice something, Abel sacrifices the animal. Cain does the wheat. And I never understood why God rejected that, why it had to be an animal. But perhaps there's like this lament, this memory that actually when you go towards agriculture, it does introduce more disease. It introduces more death. It introduces more social conflict. So all of these things that come as a result of the Abel and Cain myth, with brother killing brother and hiding, could be a mythological exploration of this genetic angst.
And moreover, it represents the fall, because you know, in this book, he repeatedly, and he uses this language very carefully, he repeatedly uses the word "by the sweat of their brow" when he's talking about the agricultural revolution, which for us is scriptural. And that was the concept, is that the Garden of Eden was to some extent a forager society, and then after the fall, we suddenly had to till the earth, and that sucked.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever sit in the temple and just kind of squirm in your chair a little bit when Satan would come down and he would say, "You could buy anything in this world for money"? And, you know, it's like, and
no, that was when I woke up, because that was the most interesting part when Satan was in the film.
Well, and then you got angels, and he's like tempting the angels. Do you have any money? And I'm just like, money. These are the first two humans. There's no economy. These are the thoughts that went through my head. That it was a cocktail that would go through my head. No one else had that.
Oh, I didn't have that, but that is a really good point. If they're literally the first two humans,
they wouldn't have a concept of money.
Well, why are they buying and selling from each other?
Well, and I thought, why did they so casually accept that this guy's walking up and talking with them if they're the only two people on the earth? Wouldn't their first question be, who the hell are you? Where did you come from?
Are you saying the temple video doesn't make sense?
I am.
Well, I thought it was interesting.
They are concerned with his clothes, though. They're like, hey, where'd you get that? Where'd you get that nice apron? That looks pretty good. What is that?
Is that like Forever 21, H&M? I want to get me one of those.
It's an emblem of my power.
Powers are priests. Power and priests.
Is he going to quote the whole thing?
Let's do a temple rap. That'll be next conference. Jehovah, next branding conference.
Michael.
We will go down.
We will go down. And then that's like the... Okay, go ahead.
The double entendre? Or...
No, I'm just saying that's like the beat kind of thread that goes through it is the, you know, that's the title is "We Will Go Down." Yeah. Maybe that, I don't know. Who knows? Maybe triple entendre. Quadruple entendre.
Yeah, it also makes Adam the first man who's a farmer, because he's commanded to till the earth and bring forth bread by the sweat of his brow. So we know for sure that there's no way that Adam was one of the first Homo sapiens. He had to at least be no more than 10,000 years ago about, because he's a farmer.
Are we still trying to make sense of this?
I think we're losing John.
Yeah, I think we are.
No, this is great. And by the way, I love Waka and Mocha and Coca. My point wasn't to criticize this podcast or those people. It's just, it's
fun. Oh man, the life of John DeLynn, where you're like thinking about something you said 45 minutes ago and who's going to get pissed off by it. So you've got to bring it back up and say, man, I hope that I didn't piss anybody off by saying those things. That's
absolutely what just happened.
Of course it is.
Oh my gosh, the Mocha and the Coca and the Waka people are going to think I was criticizing them. And then I'm going to get bitch slapped and attacked.
Public figure problems.
Exactly. You called it, Glenn. You called it. It's exactly what happened. Kim Turner's going to be mad at me now. That's what happened. Love you, Kim.
But now all the people who hate Kim hate you. You can't win, John. You can't.
I've trauma, six degrees of trauma.
So my point was that just how grain centric and agriculture centric our scriptures are, and is John's point that this book shows you that Homo sapiens are so much more than wheat. Even if God said wheat for man and whatever it is, barley for horses, or what does the word of wisdom say? It's not all about the grains.
Barley is for mild drinks. God, come on.
You're right. It's like oats for horses
Oats are for horses, as everyone knows, and tobacco is for the healing of wounds.
But to support what you're saying, Heather, I have about a ton of food storage wheat in my closet right there.
Do you really? You better not.
I inherited it. I do. Like this is a legacy of our faith, and now we know it goes back several thousand years.
Did you partake of the bread of the sacrament?
When you're in church?
You're not my bishop, Randy. I have to tell you that.
You don't have to tell me. I just asked.
No, I was busy.
I haven't been to church in so long. I don't know what I'd do. I think I'd take a handful.
Maybe. It was really interesting. It was very interesting.
I took it, and the bishop looked really pissed off when I took it.
You have no right.
You guys, so do you have any like wheat or whole grain?
You have any gluten-free?
I've actually been thinking about going to different chapels and then reviewing them on Yelp as if they were karaoke bars. You like, people really got into the music. Selection wasn't great. Snacks were okay. Drinks were tiny. 3 out of 5. I go back, but hours are weird.
I like it a lot.
So what's next?
I don't know. Do you want to keep going tonight, or are we good? What do you think?
It's late for you guys in the East Coast.
This book made me feel better about religion, believe it or not, than I did before.
Me too. Tell us how.
Oh, I've always had this theory, you know, these epic debates where people are like, is religion good? Or is it bad? Has religion been a net good for society, or has it been a net bad? And I've always felt like religion is like the thing that brought us to the dance. Like if we have ascended the ranks of organisms in the world's hierarchy, which some would argue, but I kind of think there's a reasonable case to be made. Well, religion's been inextricably linked with our progress. And so, bad things have happened, but is that religion, or is that just, you know, is religion the cart pulling the horse, or is it the cart, you know? And I think that basically what I'm saying is that myth is this way that a million people can all work together and cooperate and do something really spectacular or something really dangerous. But the point is, it's really powerful. And so you have to kind of respect religion and its power. And so as I've stopped being religious and tried to create secular community, for example, and I've seen how incredibly difficult it is, as Randy, you were saying earlier, to get liberals to kind of work together. I just thought, you know, for those of us who want to evolve beyond this magical worldview, we're not gonna do it by disposing of myth. We have to come up with a better myth. And if we don't come up with a better myth, we're gonna perish as sort of this elite, you know, thinky, you know, subculture. And by the way, a myth, you know, the power of myth is when you believe it, right? So I just think we ought to have a lot of respect for religion and how it brought us to where we are in terms of its power and its effectiveness. And if we want to transcend it, we've got to do a lot more powerful things than deconstructing everything that's out there and just kind of isolating ourselves into these little groups of individuals. Or we risk just sort of becoming irrelevant, you know? That's kind of what I felt.
Amen.
So, John, yeah. what is a better myth for you? I mean, what are the elements of a better myth, like, in your mind? What would a better myth include?
I mean, I think we're piecing it together right now. If you look at what Sam Harris is trying to do, if you look at, you know, just all those people that are kind of in the secular movements, I think you can piece together a myth that's based largely on science and the social sciences. And again, I'm talking about the term myth very broadly here, but whether it's how to raise kids or how to have healthy relationships or better music or better, better heroes, right? So instead of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and Oliver Cowdery and Moses, maybe it's Neil deGrasse Tyson, maybe it's Harriet Tubman, right? And I think it's very easy to construct a modern set of heroes, a modern set of morality that's more based in science, you know, stories that are more inspiring, music that's better, music that it not only inspires but teaches better values, and piecing together, you know, what we're trying to do, which is basically what Alain de Botton talked about in his book Religion for Atheists and in his TED Talk, which was Atheism 2.0. We need better heroes, better stories, better morality, better community, better songs, better art. That all culminates together in something sort of like a secular megachurch, really, but it is built into its code of ethics and its rules is anti-patriarchy, anti-sexual shenanigans that destroy community, anti, you know, robbing people and fleecing people of their money. And I have no idea how to do it, but I think we would be wise to kind of take that challenge seriously.
But John, my follow-up question to that is, I'm hearing what you're saying, but how is that any different than any religion that's ever been created in the history of humanity? And why is it necessarily better?
Well, I don't even know if it's possible, first of all. I mean, that's the person that figures this out, you know, hats off to them, because how do you motivate people? I'm sure this has been talked about a million times. How do you motivate people without the fear of death? How do you motivate them without fear and guilt? I don't, you know, how do you get them to pay income to a centralized source, to trust authority again, to stack chairs and unstack chairs? I don't know, but I'm just saying that if we agree with this idea that that powerful myths are what allow large groups of people to gain a lot of power and do really powerful things, well, we've got Islam on the rise, and they sure have a myth that's very compelling to a lot of people. And if all the people that value science and data and information and frankly, women and LGBT people and human rights, if they're having less and less children, and if they are unable to pull together a myth that gets them to band together into a tribe that has strength and evolutionary staying power, what happens when there's a global calamity? Who wins? Who emerges as the strong, and who sort of gets winnowed out as the survival of the weakest or the survival of the fittest? If we don't learn to band together in some cohesive way, who knows? We could be the refuse of evolution, you know.
And powerful myths like you're talking about, they don't really get made overnight. I mean, there are always exceptions to the real rules, like Scientology, where L. Ron Hubbard just makes the shit up and then people go for it. But in most cases, it's been going on for a long, even Joseph Smith didn't create Mormonism out of whole cloth, you know? And so I think when people leave the church and they're searching for something to grasp onto, trying to find something that already exists is much easier than trying to create something from scratch.
Yeah.
Well, and myths that you create yourself, you don't have that like the power that cognitive dissonance brings to it, because you already know that it's a fiction and a fabrication because you made it. You know, there's power in enculturation and indoctrination at a young age where you don't know any better.
Well, can anyone name to me a significant myth that led to a movement or a large group of people that didn't end up eventually just getting corrupted by the powerful? What
infants on thrones.
So socialism turns into fascism, or national socialism turned to fascism. Communism turned into horrific atrocities. Capitalism leads to horrible inequality of wealth.
Evolutionary humanism leads to Nazism.
So that's one that isn't really, I don't consider very powerful. They haven't garnered as much power as I would like. Humanism.
He was pretty tough on humanism, by the way, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
I thought, what is this dude's deal with humanism, man?
He has no respect for it.
Because we're speciesists.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually introduced another term that is a little off topic. Instead of racism, it's culturism. If you're a culturist. So that's the new alternate right, is they're not racist. They just think our Western culture is better. So they're culturists. Right. But can anyone, I guess, is humanism your only answer, Heather?
No, I said evolutionary humanism was corrupted and led to eugenics
and
Nazism.
Yeah, you're talking about eugenics. I thought when you meant humanism, I thought you meant modern humanism. Sorry. But yeah, like all of these myths are like, John, you're like, I give them respect for the power they have. I also have despair from this book.
Right. But this is where Andrew's comment about I think it was Andrew, the net negative versus net positive, or maybe that was John, that it really, like, this book kind of pulls religion out of the dregs of the net negative argument and says there is much more positive going on. And I feel like even with that comment that you're saying right there, Randy, it's more, yeah, there's negative things that happen. You can't pick one myth or one group or society that hasn't had like really awful atrocities happen, but is it a net negative or a net positive? And I think this book says net positive, whether it is or not.
Well, the book also says that it's a myth. I know, John, you really like the quote of Martin Luther King, that the arc of justice is long, but it bends towards, no, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. He says that's a myth, and there's no evidence for that. Like we are really influenced by the arc of the last 500 years, where, you know, before 500 years ago, people didn't assume that their grandchildren were going to have much better lives than them. But we do over the last 500 years because of the scientific revolution and the enlightenment and progress like that. There's no guarantee that that's going to last forever.
But we're better off by believing that Martin Luther King quote, because if we take that into our mythology, then we act as if it's true, and that becomes maybe a self-fulfilling prophecy. And by the way, I think the one of the secret ingredients of a myth is that you believe it. So let's say we were to create a moral code, a word of wisdom 2.0, a set of hymns and a set of heroes, and it was all these cool people. We would think it was true when we were believing it. We would be putting it together as if it were true. So for us, it wouldn't be myth. For us, it would be truth and goodness and reality. Now, 1,000 years from now, or 500 years from now, or 12 minutes from now, people might end up disproving or finding a better way. But I don't think that's bad, Randy. I mean, yeah, everything has become corrupted. But I have this optimistic myth that's still inside me, or this optimistic value that somehow society is iterating towards self-improvement, right? That women are being treated a little bit better now than they ever have been. LGBT people, people of color, we're becoming hopefully more civilized in many ways, less war. We're figuring out poverty, more literacy. It's okay if things get corrupted. The question is, are we continually improving?
Well, but even then, go ahead, Red.
Not all myths are net positive. I mean, there's no net positive in eugenics. There's no net positive in nationalism.
No, I don't think so.
There's no net positive in socialism. There's no net positive in communism.
Wow, that's a really sweeping statement. I mean, those should be examined more before I would like say, yeah, you're right.
Well, according to history.
Okay. Can I play devil's advocate? I like the world that John is describing, that we're actually evolving in our belief system to one that is more inclusive and healthier and supports us all in our pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But what I'm curious about historically, are we just trading one myth for another over and over and over again? It really is the same myth that he's talking about with the hierarchy. An example is the French Revolution, which, you know, happened in 1792. And then within a decade, you had Napoleon in power. You had a whole new system in place that was just a repetition of the same myth. I served my mission in the former Soviet Union, where most of the people I talked to were raised without any religion at all, did not believe in God. And yet, even within that very regulated system, they created their own myths, which I would say were supernatural myths that served the exact same purpose that any, you know, God-based religion would have. And so I just wonder if, as an anthropologist, if you're looking at any of these cultures or tribes, if the myth is just not the same one, we were only changing semantics.
Yeah, and that some of the reasons that we create the myths that we do, or that myths have been created, is because there are genetic memories you talked about earlier, biological needs that are similar across people, and so they create, you know, that's like the hand and the myths or the glove kind of thing. The something that came out of this book for me was the even if you can say that religion is a net positive, which I think he says, there's still this inherent genocidal tendency in us. That you go back to the very beginning of the book where he talks about all of the different genus and species, Homo sapiens, I can't remember all of them, but it seemed like there were like 10 or 15 different, what would you call them? Different species?
Species.
Different species, like the Homo.
Deacons, teachers, yeah. Priests.
Right. But the Homo sapiens wiped out all of the other homos, which made me think that we've always been a little homophobic.
John Hamm says no.
What did you just say?
We've always been a little homophobic.
This homo's represent.
It just kind of like baked into us. Is that not... That's not okay to say,
but I'm pumped.
I just had an Ali G clip come in my mind. Have you seen that one? Respect.
Yeah, but that there is this us versus them thing that we've got to look out for. That's genocide. So it's not all roses. That was really the point I was trying to make.
But I'm curious to hear from John about this, because I'm not connected with this world, but I see all of these new things happening within Mormonism and breakoffs, and you have the Snufferites and whatever secular things are happening. And I'm a pessimist, and I think it's because I've been burned, and I'm just curious, are we not just recreating the exact same myths and same problems, and 150 years from now, their descendants are going to be pissed at them for having created these myths that screwed them over?
You know, you're asking a really fair question, Andrew. I'm thinking about like the wisdom that's found in the Tao Te Ching, or, you know, in Buddhism, or even in the ancient Greeks. You think back to how smart those dudes seem to be, and think, wow, like some of the wisdom we really rely upon has been around forever. And just like we tend to think that we keep getting better as a society, all this crap around, you know, merging the United States with God and religion, that's actually a recent phenomenon. Like In God We Trust and the Pledge of Allegiance and all that stuff was actually added to all our stuff in the past like 50, 60 years. And you could argue that we've become more religiously crazy than we have secular, you know, and thoughtful. And if you read the writings of like Thomas Jefferson and some of those founders, Alexander Hamilton, it seems like we've gotten dumber, not smarter. So yeah, Andrew, I think I understand why you would maybe sometimes want to lean towards a more pessimistic view, because it is possible that we figured all this stuff out a couple centuries ago, and we just keep cycling back again over and over again into crazy. You know what I mean? Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, because I think
Trump's an example of it.
And like Trump's an example. How do we get there?
Where in the hell have we gone now, right?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example. And I just know my experience that generations and cultures that try to eradicate the mistakes from the past often just recreate the same myths.
Here's just what I'll say. If you, okay, as an LGBT person, is there any other global time period and condition in the history of mankind that you'd rather live in than 2017?
Ancient Greece?
Yeah, no, actually, yeah. I can say, because I think our concept of what LGBT, I mean, that's a good example. It could be a separate podcast, but our concept of what LGBT, that very acronym, is a myth. And the definition of what a myth is in this book, it's this agreed upon belief, it's a narrative. And there were other civilizations where men were having sex with men. It was called something else, but it wasn't viewed in the same way as it's viewed today. Because
what about globally, though? What about globally?
Well, globally, I don't think you could say that about anything, because to make any assumptions globally historically would be...
Well, I just mean like... Or being a woman.
I'm agreeing with you that rights are better now universally for LGBT people when you define rights in the modern context. But, you know, if I was taking my pick, I would rather be a gay emperor in Japan in the Edo period, because my life would have been pretty sweet.
Right. And I guess what I'm asking, and I don't know the right answer, you may be able to pick subcultures where that's true, but is there a better time in the history of the world to be a woman? Is there a better time in the history of the world to be a person of color?
Not in Saudi Arabia.
No. I mean, on average, the average experience globally, for in terms of medicine, longevity, health, education, literacy, on average, is there a better time that any of you would ever go back to if you really had to have the average experience of the average human in that time period?
I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair. We're living a better standard of living for the maximum amount of people today in all of human history.
And I'm talking war, poverty.
I heard that hunter-gatherers had it pretty good. They did. As long as you made it past childhood, I think you had a pretty good run.
Oh, there's that.
Oh, wait. Yeah. I mean, like half of them died at that point, but you made it through. You had it. You really had it.
Yeah. And Andrew, maybe optimism is part of the myth, you know, but I think we're better off as a species, maybe being optimistic than pessimistic. I think it's more adaptive. Possibly it could be, you know.
I would agree with you on that point. I am not contesting that. I'm wary of, you know, you said that at the beginning that we're all kind of entrenched in this Mormonism. We can't break away from it, but none of us can look at any institutionalized,
myself included, by the way, myself.
Yeah. Included. Right. But like, we can't, I can't look at any church or any group or any club and not have a bit of trauma. You know, yeah. I still have yet to join any society since I left the church, because I think once you've been kicked out of a tribe, as you and I have been, John, you know, and that is tribalism. And they talk about very cruel methods in a lot of societies about how they protected the good of the tribe by, you know, killing people, which is the Mormon equivalent, you know, excommunication. And so now I feel that I'm wary of any myth, a unifying myth that creates a tribe, because I don't necessarily think it's a new thing or a good thing.
Yeah, no, we are traumatized. And by the way, you're talking to someone who brought five chapters of Oasis to Utah, and I can't even get myself or my family to really go on a Sunday, because I enjoy my Sundays, and I have so much trauma about joining organizations. But here's the flip side of that. I've been studying the Pew Foundation's data on the rise of the nuns, and if we as secular people think that it's just a given that we'll raise our children and they'll continue to be secular, we're fooling ourselves. Something like 40% of children raised secular convert back to religion. I think children raised secular maybe have the highest retention rates of all, but it's just not a given. And so that's what I left this book feeling, is if we hate the myths that birthed our trauma, the best thing maybe we could do for ourselves and for future generations is to create better ones. Because if we don't, if not us, our future generations, we risk them falling prey to something that falls back in this cycle of ignorance and bigotry. And I don't want that for my kids, my grandkids. I don't want that for humanity. And so I think it's beholden on us to think about that. And Glenn, to your point, it may take 500 years, you know, it probably will. But I hope that people listening consider the importance of it. And there's got to be a way to do it without stealing people's money, without sleeping with their daughters and wives, without lying and basing it on fiction. I'm foolish enough to be optimistic that there's a way to put this formula together where we could do it, or at least that it's maybe the most important thing we could think about.
What about you, Jake?
Yeah, I'm for it.
Woo!
I was looking,
yes!
All in favor.
Yes.
I was looking for your takeaway from the book since we're wrapping up.
Yeah. I mean, I also, I don't know. I mean, I think our religious myths, I mean, maybe in the future are going to be obviously very different than what we're talking about now. And maybe we're the people that are kind of stuck in the, that kind of fall through the cracks of myths that span, that connects generations to each other, right? Maybe we are the link that breaks the chain, or a particular branch of the chain. And we just kind of fall through the cracks of transcendent.
So that's what it means identities. For us to be a chosen generation, Jake. We are the right. generation that breaks the chain.
I mean, yes, but
they
but
were the right. Other one, we're special.
Maybe we're just weird cultural orphans that, you know, end up kind of unmoored, and we muddle our way through, and then, you know, our kids kind of figure it out later, and we're the prototypes of some sort of grand vision that comes together later. I like what John is saying, but I also don't, I can't even think of any sort of organization, religious type, community based organization that's built around an ideology that would get me out of, that would get me to church on Sundays, right? That would get me up and dressing a particular way that I usually don't dress, going to a certain place at a time that I usually don't go there, on a day that otherwise I would have free. Like, I just don't see any sets of beliefs that would get me to do that again.
And Jake, can I ask, are you part of any other tribes today?
Not in the same. I don't know. I mean, if the comparison I'm making is between my behavior now and my behavior as a Mormon, I'm not a member of any tribe that motivates and well, I guess maybe. I mean, usually I wouldn't be up at 10:30 at night, so maybe Infants on Thrones is my tribe. Maybe
the company you work for is a tribe.
That's true. That's true. And I went on a company retreat recently and I talked to them, and I also got in hot water by using the term fiction with them, where I was like, okay, the company that I went on a company retreat, and I was like, the purpose of this company retreat is to reinforce the collective fiction that this company exists and that we're part of it. And they're like, oh, fiction. Oh, no.
And I got the exact same thing.
Yeah. I got the exact same. I had gotten the
you became the Glenn of that conversation, right, is exactly what you're trying to say. Going. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So, but I made a sick ass pun later and redeemed myself just like you did.
So. Oh yeah. That was a redemptive pun. Yeah. I was watching everybody's face on that one. Yeah.
Saved it.
So, I agree. I am part of other tribes. But they don't feel like they get, I'm happy to work for the company that I work for, but ultimately, if I wasn't paid, like, I wouldn't pay to be part of that company, right? I am part of that company because they pay me.
I know, that's a fundamental difference.
Right. Yeah, that's why anybody's a member of any group, because of what they get out of it. Because they get out of it more than they put into it. You're just talking about money.
Yeah,
itself, what did he say about money?
Also a construct,
also a myth, also a fiction. Yeah. Right. And the next world that's what John's looking for in 500 years. It'll all be Bitcoin.
Andrew, are you part of another tribe? I mean, have you joined?
Yeah, we're all part of tribes. And I think that today when you see a secularization happen, the next generation is creating, I mean, we have a neo-tribalism. When you look at something like Burning Man in Nevada and how that began and what it's turned into, when you look at something like a Ragnar Relay and the way people act when they're doing these sporting events, these are all, to me, pointing back to rites and rituals that we've been doing for thousands of years as Homo sapiens. And I just think it's human nature. And I'm not saying, I mean, I was talking about being a pessimist. I'm an optimist in that this book enlightened me, like John was saying, because to me, it put my own experience in Mormonism into context of, we're not that special. This has been going on forever. And it just happens to be the one brand that we hit in time and space. And to me, I actually find that comforting. It makes it a more comparative experience for me.
I found it comforting too. It reminded me, reading this book was like Moses' experience in the Book of Moses, where he sees all of the worlds and everything that God has created in the history of man. And his response is, wherefore I know that I am nothing, which thing I never had supposed. And I found it very humbling to look at the entire history of the human race, and it gave me respect for religion and the amount that it's been able to accomplish, which John was arguing for, which I think is true. But it also made me realize, yeah, like none of this, all of these ethoses that we are talking about are
I think
ways
the plural is ethi.
Is it ethi?
I think it's ethi.
thank you. are just arbitrarily ascribing meaning to something. That's what all religion is. We ascribe meaning to, you know, whether or not it rains or something. And humanism, why are we privileging our species? Oh, like, why is my life so much more important than Andrew's dog's life? Liberalism, life. Lives.
I would eat your dogs if there was a famine.
So right. Would we all.
My dogs would eat you first. I thought what he said about dogs in the book was fascinating, that they are the exception to the rule because they can read humans. Like, if anybody's feeling the spirit today, it's dogs, because they can read people's minds and they can react to us emotionally.
Well, they were the first domesticated animal. They've been with man for a longer time. But so all of these ethi are just arbitrary ascriptions of meaning. Like if the human race does kill itself, then, you know, the cockroaches will take over. Maybe it'll take them a billion years, but maybe they'll do something interesting. If we wipe out all life on Earth, then, you know, the galaxy and the universe will keep on spinning and there's probably life somewhere else and other consciousnesses. Like, it doesn't matter. That was really comforting and liberating to me to say, all right, well, so you can choose to subscribe to religion or utilitarianism or to any philosophy or to any ethos that you think is going to be, you hope and bet is going to be a net positive. And even if you know that it's a construct and a fiction, if you, that you can still base your life on it and let it make you happy, whether it's objective reality or not.
Well, maybe the reason I was so hesitant to say whether or not I was part of a tribe now when Andrew asked was the same reason, like it's related to that kind of latent belief in the singularity of humans that are there. They are separate. We're not just, I guess, disabusing myself of the idea that we're not just a point on the spectrum of the of animals that have existed in the world, in the same way that it's hard for me to point to Mormonism, or it feels transgressive to me anyway, to point to my Mormon experience as just a point on the spectrum of fictions to which I have subscribed at one point. Right. It's not like this completely unique experience where like I was part of the chosen people, but then I fell away, you know, this narrative of like, this was this incredibly unique experience that I had that nobody else can have in any way. But oh no, of course we're all experiencing those types of things. We're all parts of overlapping tribes in many ways at any given point. And the fact that it's jarring to us is that we were on a particularly, you know, divergent point on the spectrum versus where we are now, but it doesn't mean that Mormonism isn't just one of many fictions that exists to which we can choose to subscribe or not, or create a better myth.
I think If It's on Thrones is a tribe for sure, and your followers, I meet them all the time, they love you guys, and I don't know what comes out of it, but you guys are shaping the consciousness of tens of thousands of people.
And wow, that's overstating it by a couple tens of thousands.
No, no, it's not.
Dozens and dozens.
Yeah.
Who knows what that leads to, though? You know, who knows?
This is Hillary.
Matthew Ryan.
Carol.
Keith.
Ashley. And I like to play bingo online while listening to Infants on Thrones.
You can comment on this episode on the website, infantsonthrones.com.
And if you really like what you hear, give The Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes.
I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
All right, I want to take a few minutes to go through the survey for anybody who wants to stick around and hear about that. The song, by the way, International Good Year by Donald Fagen of Steely Dan. Well, that's a nice feel-good way to end 2017. What a beautiful world it could be. That's a nice hope for 2018. So, okay, so here is the previous intro that's just way too long. I published it. I woke up in the morning and went, no, that's just too much to inflict on people who don't want to hear me monologuing like me. I don't like hearing myself monologuing. These are things that I've wanted to say. These are things that I've wanted to talk about for a long time. And maybe there've been pieces of them that I've talked about, or I've interjected something here and there, like I did at the beginning of this conversation about the book Sapiens, but it's something that I think is important, and especially with what John was making the point, we need to have a better mythology because of what a myth does in tying people together, and because science is able to verify
and update our narrative with the most common current scientific understandings, that's the best kind of like Reese's Pieces. You've got your chocolate and my peanut butter is stuck in my chocolate. You know, that kind of like combination of myth-making stuff. So what does it mean to have a mythology? I go into this in a lot of pedantic detail. And this is an Easter egg for anybody who wants to listen to it. But if you don't want to at this point, you could just turn it off. If you haven't already, if you've already turned it off, then what am I doing? All right, so here we go. A really long Easter egg with a bunch of stuff in it. A quick word about a word. Lesson number one, when I say it's quick,
a quick word about a word. Myth. The word myth.
Now, thanks to all of you who filled out the survey and provided feedback to part one, which you heard last week. I'm going to read and respond to your comments at the end of today's episode as an extended Easter egg. And I'll also say a word or two about the new Star Wars movie and how I think that that ties into this whole myth and fiction thing, but I want to do it without spoilers and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, that'll be at the end of today's episode. But what I want to say up front is the overwhelming realization that I had from reading your comments, and this is going to sound more condescending than I feel it, but that most of you are pretty ignorant, steady, about what myth actually is and what myth actually means. Now, that's probably because most of you were not crazy enough to dedicate years of your life to the detailed, pedantic study of folklore and traditional culture like I did. So to most of you, myth simply means a story that isn't true. Myth means false. Kind of like how gay means homosexual. Michael, Scott, could you help me out with this one?
Did you know that gay used to mean happy? When I was growing up, it meant lame. And now it means a man who makes love to other men. We're all homos. Homo sapiens.
That's right, Michael. Homo sapiens. And by the way, you know, this episode does center around a discussion about the book Sapiens, where we learned that there were other homos in our ancestry as well. There was Homo habilis, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo erectus, and a bunch of other homos that the sapiens totally wiped out, destroyed, genocide. It's in our DNA out of fear of the other homos? I don't know. An ancient form of homophobia? Maybe. And just as a heads up, beware of anyone who tries to make a pun like that as a joke, because they're probably just full of shit. So anyway, when it comes to myth, kind of like the word gay, the current most common understanding of the word isn't really what the word means or has meant. And you know, like the word gay was turned into an insult where people would take this pejorative look at it. That's what happened with the word myth, because we would look at other people's cultures and go, oh, your myth, that's silly. What you guys think is the origin of the universe, that can't be true. You know, two turtles, whatever, there's all kinds of strange myths out there. But ours about, you know, a man and a woman that eat fruit from a tree that a talking snake gave them the fruit, you know, like that myth, that's legit, you know. So it's like this pejorative view of myth that has infiltrated our culture, that till now we just think of myth as being something that's not true. And that's kind of why I have a strong reaction against myth that you heard in part one. But that's not really what myth is, and that's not really where myth came from. And who better to help us understand what the word originally meant than scholars and academics who have devoted their lives to the detailed pedantic studying of mythology, comparing these stories, identifying the common characteristics that make them what they are. So before we go to the panel discussion, I want to review some of these characteristics of myth so that you can understand why I was calling it myth, why I was talking about this as fiction. And by the time you finish this episode today, I hope that you will see that myth is not a synonym for false. It's definitely not a synonym for no value or for stupid. It's a word that describes an incredibly powerful narrative that unites people and informs their worldview. And a scientific mythology?
Scientific mythology.
A flexible but sacred narrative built on the foundations of testable evidence and verifiable objective facts? That kind of scientific mythology is absolutely something that we should all be marching towards. So, what are the characteristics of a myth? Okay, I am going to be reading from a webpage that I'll place a link on our website under this episode if anybody wants to check it out. It has a lot of very detailed scholarly information about myths. But what I want to do is just go through this list of 12 characteristics of a myth. And it says, given the cautions above, which I'm not going to read all the cautions above, about how much the definition of myth has been debated and written about, take the following characteristics of myth in the spirit in which they are intended. So these are general guidelines gleaned from what many people have noticed as often being true of myths. And these characteristics are neither absolute nor all-encompassing. And one of the sources of these myths was a guy named Gregory Shremp, who was one of my professors at Indiana University. So I got this from him in a class on mythology and worldview, and it just kind of has stuck with me for the last 20 years. Anyway, so the first one is that a myth is a story that is or was considered a true explanation of the natural world and how it came to be. So that's one characteristic of a myth. And I should say, there's a difference between a story and a fact. And I think a lot of the things that were being debated in the discussion of part one was like scientific facts versus a narrative that's strung together. So this is talking, a myth is a story. It's a narrative. And it doesn't mention this here, but it's also traditional. So it's not just something that one person made up, but it's something that has gone through communal recreation. You don't really know who the author is. It's just this traditional story that's been passed down. It's an old story that we inherit. Okay, number two, characters in the myths are often non-humans. Example, gods, goddesses, supernatural beings, the first people. You might add to that the cosmos or the universe. So characters that are non-human. Three, the setting for a myth is in a previous proto world. It's somewhat like this world, but it's also different. So there you go. Number four, the plot may involve interplay between worlds, interplay between this world and the previous or original world. Five, it depicts events that bend or break natural laws, so it's reflective of connections to previous worlds. Number six, it is a cosmological or metaphysical explanation of the universe, how it formed, and then this then becomes a very important part of forming a person's worldview about what's right or wrong, what's true, what's not. So this is a key part of myth, that it informs your worldview. Number seven, it can be functional. It's a charter for social action. It conveys how to live, assumptions, values, core meanings of individuals, families, and communities. I mean, that's all part of the worldview. Number eight, it evokes the presence of mystery. There's this unknown. It has a sacred tinge. And if we're using the word sacred, we might want to think of the episode that Matt and I did where we were talking about the Jonathan Haidt TED Talk. And Jonathan Haidt was talking about Emile Durkheim and how there was the profane and the sacred. And the profane is all about the individual, and the sacred is about groups connecting in groups. When you think about a myth that connects groups together, that's the sacred element right there. And it's one of the reasons why you don't want your mythology challenged, because it's sacred to you. And so you will argue against your mythology being challenged. Number nine, reflective, informative of basic structures. So there's dualities like light and dark, good and bad, being and nothingness, raw or cooked, things like this that we must reconcile. These dualities are often mediated by characters and myth. So if we're saying that the Big Bang story is potentially maybe a scientific myth, ask yourself, are there these kinds of dualities? Are these characteristics that I've been talking about here, did they apply to this story that we have about the Big Bang and how the universe came to be, and how the story of molecules, or what, how did he say it? He said it something like molecules came to be, and the story of how they interact we call chemistry. He calls it a story right there. Harari does. Anyway, number 10, it becomes a common theme among people that helps order the world. And it may include different lists, different names, different things that people will use to say, this is how the world is. It provides a common theme to people. Number 11, it can be metaphoric, narrative considerations that explain the ontology, or the study of being, where myths seek to answer questions like, why are we here? Who are we? What is our purpose? They address the questions of life, or they address life's fundamental questions. Anyway, and I'm looking at number 12 here, and I don't really even understand what it's saying, so I'm not going to read it. But again, this link is on the website, so if you want to look at this. So when I'm talking about a mythology, I'm not saying that that science isn't true or that science is false. I'm saying that these are stories, these are narratives that are so important to our understanding, to informing our worldview. And the added benefit, I should have had the presence of mind to say this in the course of the discussion that we had a few months ago, but the fact that these narratives are being built around testable, verifiable data, or at least our best understanding at any given point in time, that means that these are the best possible myths that we could have. And I'm not doing like a cultural relativistic thing, or, you know, whatever. I'll address these things at the end of this episode when I read the specific comments and respond to that. Anyway, the last thing that I want to do, and thank you, Craig Keeling, who does the artwork for Infants on Thrones. He was reading Sapiens, and he found, I think it's page 411, towards the end, where Yuval Harari, the author of Sapiens, actually does talk about our scientific mythology.
The Frankenstein Prophecy. In 1818, Mary Shelley published Frankenstein, the story of a scientist who tries to create a superior being and instead creates a monster. In the last two centuries, this story has been told over and over again in countless variations. It has become a central pillar of our new scientific mythology. At first sight, the Frankenstein story appears to warn us that if we try to play God and engineer life, we will be punished severely. Yet the story has a deeper meaning. The Frankenstein myth confronts Homo sapiens with the fact that the last days are fast approaching. Unless some nuclear or ecological catastrophe intervenes, so goes the story, the pace of technological development will soon lead to the replacement of Homo sapiens by completely different beings who possess not only different physiques, but also very different cognitive and emotional worlds. It has become a central pillar of our new scientific mythology.
So it's not that much of a stretch. What I'm saying isn't inconsistent with what Harari is saying about mythology as being a shared, intersubjective understanding of reality that is a fiction that's put together. And because it'll be updated by better information later that comes through the scientific method, it's really the best kind of the best kind of mythology that we could have would be a scientific mythology. They're not mutually exclusive ideas. Anyway, dead horse. I keep beating it over and over again. I don't know, some people still aren't going to believe it or get it, whatever. So on with the episode. Here's the panel discussion.
Whoa. See what I mean? That wasn't quick. Anyway, and I don't know how much it all really helps or applies to that first discussion about mythology or not, but whatever. Now for the survey results for those of you who responded to the survey, and I hope that you continue to respond to the survey. I'd like to hear more of what you have to say.
There were 38 people in the course of the last 6 days who filled out the survey. I'm not going to go through each one of the responses, but kind of interesting to see. Of the 38, 27 were guys, 11 were female. And let's see here.
So I asked the question, how interested are you in hearing more episodes like this on Infants on Thrones? Very interested, interested, not interested, or I would hate it. Most people, 27 of the 38, said very interested. 9 said interested. 2 said not interested. But so thank you for at least filling out the survey, even though you weren't interested in this conversation. The next question I asked was, how comfortable are you calling the science-based origin of the universe story, i.e. the Big Bang story, a myth? And again, basically the same options. Very comfortable. I can completely agree that those stories function as myths. And I said that specifically, function as myths, because that's a key part there. So that was actually the slight majority. 12 people were very comfortable with it. 11 people were somewhat comfortable with it. And then 11 more were not comfortable. I mostly disagree that those stories function as myths. And then 4 people said, no friggin' way. I don't agree that those stories are anything like a myth. Hopefully, after this episode where I defined what a myth is and what it means to for a story to function like a myth, maybe you understand better. Maybe you would change your answer based on having that definition of myth as part of the question that you're considering. Maybe not. But that was an interesting response. So kind of divided, but mostly on the somewhat comfortable to very comfortable side took the day of the 38 people. See, I told you it's dozens and dozens of people. 38 that filled out the survey in a week. The next question was, how comfortable are you admitting that everything you know is a fiction? So the first one I was specifically focusing on the Big Bang story. This one is that everything you know is a fiction. And very comfortable were 14. Very comfortable. I completed everything that I think I know is a fiction, meaning that it's incomplete and it's not a true, accurate representation of everything that is, right? 17 people, this was the largest response, said somewhat comfortable, I mostly agree. And then there were 4 people that said I'm not comfortable, I mostly disagree that everything I think I know is a fiction. And then there were 3 people that were no friggin' way, I don't agree that everything I know is a fiction. But again, the majority there were people who recognized that our knowledge of things is incomplete, our ability to observe and understand what's out there, what is reality, is limited, and so of course it's going to be a fiction, and we're going to keep filling it in with new, better information as we keep getting new, better information. I think it's so important that we recognize that everything that we think we know is a fiction. And one of the reasons that I put in these clips, the fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, from George Bush and then from The Office, mainly in episode 1. Or in part one of this, was that, you know, I felt that growing up with this sense of certainty that my fiction, my myth, my Mormonism was the truth about the universe, I totally bought into that and developed my own arrogant sense of arrogant self-righteousness around that certainty. And that's something that I don't want to fall into that trap again. I don't want to substitute my dogmatic view of religion, my Mormon religion. I don't want to just substitute that for a dogmatic, unflexible, unhumble scientific view that isn't open to really testing and exploring and looking at the evidence of things, you know. So that's an important thing for me personally, one of my values, to recognize that what I know is incomplete and limited, and we can call that fiction. I can call that fiction, be comfortable with it. But that's what I wanted to get across with this. So I've selected a few responses. I'm not going to read all 38, but I had 2 more questions. One was, can you think of a better word than myth when talking about science-based origin stories? What would that word be? And I'll read a couple of those. And then the final question was, what do you think of this conversation in general? Is there anything in particular you want to say to Heather, Randy, Jake, John, Andrew, or Glenn? So let me start with that first question. Can you think of a better word than myth? And somebody said, several people said narrative. So this person explained it a little bit more, narrative, because the term myth has a pejorative connotation. and implies falsehood. It doesn't mean falsehood, but to use the term myth is to create the need for a definition discussion at practically every turn in the conversation. Narrative, though, is simply the structure of placing ideas, information, events, memories, imagination, and/or facts into a cohesive structure to make sense. Myths, fictions, science, history, and my first lost tooth can all fit under the same structure of a narrative without creating confusion. We can still discuss the nature of reality, the unifying and excluding properties of narratives, and the limits and powers of our individual and group narratives, and I believe that we should. But I don't think we sacrifice humility when we recognize the cultural and connotative interpretation of myth, and I do think the term narrative is both more accurate and less abrasive, and therefore more likely to foster discussion and understanding rather than squabbling over vocabulary. Okay. Probably. You're probably right. The reason that narrative doesn't quite scratch the itch for me is because there's so many different things that can be narratives. And the most important distinction of a myth to other kinds of narratives is the way that it informs our worldview and that it's this shared, sacred narrative. that has all the characteristics that I read off at the beginning of this episode that distinguish a myth. And I think what you're highlighting here in your response is that most people don't know that that's what is implied when you say myth. So you have to make a definition at every turn in the conversation, which becomes pedantic and insufferable. But it's still hard for me to just say narrative, but okay, I'll take this in stride. So thank you for the response. Here's another one there. What word would work better than myth? Evidence-based narrative construct. Okay, that's not a word, but evidence-based narrative construct. And then a similar rationale here. Myth allows too wide a net that captures anything regardless of its internal coherence or usefulness. That captures anything, regardless of its internal coherence or usefulness? Oh, come on. I don't agree with this one, because when you're talking about the usefulness, that's the function. And really what I saw in all of these responses, almost all 38 of the responses, hardly anybody talked about the function of the narrative as a way of defining what it is that we're talking about. So anyway, I kind of disagree with this one starting off, but let me finish reading it. He says, I understand why Glenn wants to call the origin story a myth, given that we scientists change our mind over time. No, that's not really why, but I'll come back to that. The trouble I have is that myths are not rooted in some kind of evidence, or that myths that are not rooted in some kind of evidence can be anything, i.e. invisible flying spaghetti monster, through some pre-Earth pasta at a proto-universe canvas that dripped into the pieces that created the planets. This myth is about as good as an old bearded white guy took 6 days to create the Earth in a less than coherent process. How useful are these myths other than unifying a tribe? Okay, well, hang on. I'm sorry, there's more to read here, but how useful are these myths other than unifying a tribe? That isn't useful enough by itself. That's a pretty important, powerful function. But the person who wrote this response is so focused on the truthfulness of the elements of the story that the function of it isn't as important, it looks like to me. Okay, back to the response. Ultimately, a narrative construct informs understanding in a specifically useful way in terms of defining how hypotheses can be put forward, tested, and then put to use. Myths function as unifiers for cultures. Science-based constructs may have a secondary objective of unifying a tribe of scientists. However, the process of deciding whether a particular construct is useful or correct is based on evidence as opposed to a myth, which tends to be accredited over time, or which tends to be an accredited over time story, not grounded in much other than oral or written traditions and enforced by some authority granted power over the tribe by its members. Okay, there's more to myth than what you're giving it credit for in here, and there's more to unifying a culture and all the things that go into unifying a culture, having a worldview that then impacts the way that you view the world and that people within that tribe view the world, depending on how strong and unifying this myth is. So evidence-based narrative construct. Ultimately, I think I agree that, that's what a good scientific myth should be, is an evidence-based narrative construct that then functions as a new mythology. But okay, anyway, thank you for that comment. I'll just do one more. What word would be better than myth? Fiction. The word myth is too associated with legend. Okay, all right. Not much to say there that I haven't already said. So on to the next question. What did you think of this conversation? Is there anything in particular you would like to say to Heather, Randy, Jake, John, Andrew, or Glenn? And I've got a few responses here. One, I love these kinds of conversations. They make me think through my own biases, allow for concessions, and are all sorts of nerdy fun. Yay! Yay! That's my favorite response. Perfect. That's exactly what I'd love to do. You know, I worry sometimes. I don't know. Worry is probably not the right word. But in putting out all these podcasts and for doing it as long as I've been doing, I just hope that people recognize I'm thinking through this too. I'm not preaching what I think is the absolute truth that you guys have to see it this way or whatever. I know it sounds like that with the way that I'm talking about myth right now, but in general, I like having these conversations and then listening back to them for these reasons that were articulated here. They make me think through my own biases. They allow for concessions, and they're all sorts of nerdy fun. So yes, thank you very much. That's what I'm aiming for. Another response. I couldn't turn it off. It was fascinating. I like the respect that you have for each other. I say that because you follow a thread, no matter how strange it seems, and you are kind to each other as you do it. This is what impresses me most. No one is summarily dismissing the other because they're wrong. But Heather's use of the word narrative is correct. She adds in there. So, oh, well, thank you for that comment too. I hope that's right. I hope that it is respect that we show for each other and that we're able to power through our disagreements, even with this episode here. So thank you very much for that comment. Another one. I found all of the arguments interesting, but ended up siding with Glenn, John, and Andrew. Facts exist, but the way we present them to ourselves and each other has a narrative quality because that is how we process information and connect facts. Our brains are wired to like stories and a narrative structure. Citation needed, winky face. The wiki answer there. I'm perfectly comfortable with calling the story of the Earth's creation a myth because it seems to fit the bill. It is a story, a series of events, and not an outright fact. Sure, the events almost certainly happen that way with those facts, but it doesn't make it less than a myth. My family has the story about an ancestor who got kidnapped by Native Americans. There are historical records that this actually happened. However, these events have been strung together into a myth. It doesn't make it any less true or less real. That's right. And that story that you have, you know, if I'm being really folklore pedantic, would call it a legend instead of a myth. But then I would have to define the characteristics of legend, and I'm not going to do that. But you're right. It's not really about true or false. It's how it functions, and that story with your family functions as a unifier for your family and connecting you to your ancestors. So that's good there. Thank you for that. And then the last comment here. I'm a guy who loves to hear Heather's opinion. However, you guys need more female reps to balance things out. All right. Okay, fine. How? I mean, come on. we're doing an essay contest in 2018. So females who want your voice to be part of the conversation on Infants on Thrones, open invitation. Come join us. Do a listener essay. I've only got a couple so far, so we're going to have to push it back, I think, until we get, like, I'd like to get at least 10 listener essays before I really start the contest. Right now we've got two. And so whether it's more female voices or male voices or any other kinds of voices, you know, I guess what I would say to this is don't expect Infants on Thrones to be a perfect balance of every viewpoint and perspective. We'll continue to be as open and inclusive as possible, but I would leave that up to you to balance the things that you're listening to so that you're not just listening to a bunch of guys. There's other things out there that you can find. You don't have to get everything from Infants on Thrones. So anyway, that's what I'm going to say. And as far as the Star Wars stuff, okay, what to do here? What I'd really like to do. So I for those of you who support us on Patreon, you'll be familiar that in the last month, I started a new little segment that was kind of based on Deep Thoughts by Jack Handy, the Saturday Night Live thing, where, you know, I'll just record some random thoughts and share them with you. I call it sharing time, nursery hour, something like that. And you don't get charged for that. It's just part of being on Patreon. You get little extra pieces of the Infants, at least from me at this point. So one of those that I did was a rant about Star Wars. So I'm going to play that. I'm going to play right now the rant that I gave after I saw Star Wars the first time. It does contain spoilers, so if you haven't seen Star Wars and you don't want spoilers, just shut the podcast off now. But I did not like it the first time that I saw it. The second time I saw it was a very different experience. So I'm going to play my rant for you now, and then I'll talk about the second time I saw it.
Welcome back to Infant Nursery Hour with your host, Glenn Ostlund. It's sharing time.
Today is a very sad day for me. Yesterday I went and I saw the new Star Wars movie, Star Wars The Last Jedi. If you haven't seen it, and you want to see it, and you don't want any spoilers, and you don't want anybody to shit on it, then just turn this off right now. I love Star Wars. Like, ever since when I was a little kid. So I was born in 1972. And when did the first one come out? Like, 76, 77? You know, like, I just grew up side by side with Star Wars. This is a little Star Wars action figure. I wish I could say that it was one that I had, you know, when I was a kid. It's like a Luke Skywalker. I think it's from Empire Strikes Back era. And, like, I never really loved Luke as a character, but Luke was my temple name. And so, like, when I went through the temple and they're like, your secret name is Luke, I went, cool, okay, so I can be kind of like the potential of Luke. Not like the whiny little crybaby Luke. I didn't want to be that Luke. But, yeah, Luke. And, you know, like, every once in a while, like, my kids now for Christmas, they'll give me little Star Wars figurines. I used this, this was my cover, I don't know if you can see it, Darth Vader and a stormtrooper visiting the Eiffel Tower in Paris and taking a picture. That was my iPhone cover for a long time. You know, I love Star Wars. Tom got me these three Nephite action figures. It doesn't have anything to do with Star Wars, but it's awesome. I'm never going to take this out of the packaging, Tom. Thank you. But man, what happened? What happened with this new movie? It's terrible. Stupid. It's stupid. It's terrible. It's so bad. Like, everything that people wanted, or at least that I wanted, to, like, who is the Snoke guy? Who is Snoke? Supreme Leader Snoke. Supreme Leader Snoke. Who is this guy? What is his backstory? How did he get to where he was and, like, turn everything back into the Empire? Is that something that you're interested in? Well, you're not going to find any answers in the new Star Wars movie because, who cares about that? Let's just have him, we'll recreate the Emperor scene from Return of the Jedi and have Kylo Ren kill Snoke the way that Darth Vader killed the Emperor. But you never know anything about it. You know, like, we'll do it in a different way, kind of, and it'll be a little different, but the same, but it's not. It's stupid. It's stupid. It's stupid. It's stupid. Who is Snoke? Where does he come from? Why? Years of speculating on the internet. People went with their theories who this guy is. Nothing. No mention of it. Nothing. 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 It's stupid. Rey, her parentage. Where did she come from? Kylo Ren tells her, oh no, you just had these normal parents that were desert rats and they lie in a grave on Jakku. That's it. They weren't special. They weren't part of anything. They're not part of the story. You have no place in this story. That's what Kylo Ren tells her. It's stupid. So maybe in the next movie they'll be like, oh no, actually, Obi-Wan Kenobi's your father. Who knows? But who cares? At this point, it made me not care. Rian Johnson, the director and writer of this movie, made me not care about Star Wars. It's stupid. Fuck you, Rian Johnson. Jeez. It's stupid. It's terrible. It's so bad. Like, everything that people wanted, or at least that I wanted, to like, who is the Snoke guy? Who is Snoke? What, how does Rey fit into this story? All of these really interesting questions, they just took a big pass on. It's like, no, we're not going to talk about that. Instead, we're going to show, like, Princess Leia being blown up on a ship and being thrust out into deep space and, like, floating in deep space. And then her eye opens up and she starts using the Force to fly through space back to the spaceship where she's led. What? This is Star Wars? When has that ever happened? Or at the end where Luke Skywalker finally shows up to save the day and he's battling Kylo Ren and all of the empires, these big AT-ATs, and they're like, boop, 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 you know, like every single gun firing at him. And he walks up like, okay, oh, really? Oh, come on. And he doesn't get hit. And then he has this epic, epic lightsaber duel with Kylo Ren. And you're thinking, okay, they're going to do like an Obi-Wan Kenobi thing. And no, actually what they're doing is Luke's not even really there. He's still on the planet and he's meditating and he's just projecting his image onto this planet. And they've been like, what? What precedent is there for this level of magic in the Star Wars universe? When did this happen? That this is like the big got you moment twist? I mean, it's like Mission Impossible when, oh, it's not really the guy you think it is because he's wearing a mask, and they pull it off and they do that every movie. Like it's a Scooby-Doo episode. I was so upset with Star Wars The Last Jedi. It's so bad. It's stupid. You know, there was one part that I liked. I liked it when Luke was starting to tell Rey about what the Force is. He was talking about how it's a connection between things. Because I've been, obviously, the types of episodes you've been hearing on Infants on Thrones, this idea of connection and spirituality is way more interesting to me now than it ever used to be before. And I've been watching these Nova documentaries. It was this Fabric of the Cosmos by Brian Greene. They did it in 2011. Talking about how there's really no such thing as empty space. There's energy in everything. And the universe where they thought that there's empty space, no, there's dark energy. There's this dark matter. We don't know what it is. We don't know anything about it, but we know that it's there. And so there is this energy, this connectivity. There's no empty space, right? And so using Star Wars to talk about the Force as a way to explore that idea, that's pretty cool. This idea of, like, could there actually be multiple dimensions? What is quantum theories telling us? You know, this kind of stuff. Back when Rey's standing in the dark side place on that island, and she's looking into, like, whatever mirror that was, she sees different versions of herself all snapping or doing that. That was potentially interesting, but they didn't take it anywhere. The connection between her and Kylo, like I just watched this thing about electrons and electrons having a connection, and I forget what the term is for it. I'll look it up and I'll talk about it some other time, but that electrons can actually have a connection to a polar opposite that, you know, I'm like, oh, this may be what's going on here. This cool idea, but they didn't do anything with it. Then they're just like, oh no, that was just a trap to try to get you to do something to recreate a scene, but in a shittier way than the way we did it in Return of the Jedi. Stupid. Oh, what a disappointment. What a disappointment. I'm disappointed. Stupid. Anyway, that's all. You know, 2 years ago when The Force Awakens came out, we did an episode about it, and I liked it, and John Hamer didn't, and, you know, we had our debate. Look, I'm wearing a Star Wars shirt. right now. I love Star Wars. And they killed it. It's like they just killed my mythology from my childhood to where I can't love it anymore. I've already had that happen with the Mormon Church. I don't want to have that happen with Star Wars. Come on, let me have something, please. Let me have something. So, I don't know, if you're in the same place, if you're in the same place, or maybe you saw it and you liked it, let me know. I'd love to hear what you thought. That's all. That's today's little deep thought or whatever I'm calling the nursery sharing time. I'm just sharing this about Star Wars. That's it. That's all there is. Thanks for being Patreon supporters. Thanks. I like it. I like you guys better than I like Star Wars. How's that? That's positive. Positivity, baby. Positivity. Okay, so clearly, dipping into my Jonathan Haidt here, that was a really emotionally charged elephant that was just bursting out, right? That, how dare you, Rian Johnson, writer and director of the new Star Wars movie, how dare you take my childhood mythology that's sacred to me and desecrate it and blow it up like the first Death Star. How dare you, sir? How dare you? I was really angry and I thought it was stupid, right? That's kind of his point, I think. I think I was illustrating something that needed to happen, that Rian Johnson recognized needed to happen. And I can't tell you exactly what happened between the first time I saw it and the second time I saw it. But maybe it was just getting out all of that emotion. And I had made the claims that Rian Johnson was not being a very good storyteller. And so the second time I saw it, I had to back up those claims because emotionally I felt that. And now, like, my rational post hoc writer needed evidence to construct and support that narrative. And what happened as I was watching the choices that he was making, and I was doing it without all of the emotion that I had the first time, I started seeing that it wasn't that he wasn't telling a good story. He was telling a very good story and doing it in a very good way. It just wasn't what I wanted and wasn't what I was expecting the second time, or the first time. But what I started to see was that, and I think this is connecting into a larger theme that I'm seeing in other places besides Star Wars, and I'll talk about more of these in upcoming episodes in 2018. But it seems that there is a growing dissatisfaction with the way that things are, especially consumerism, capitalism, politics, this whole system where people's needs are really not being met, and that there needs to be some kind of a change, maybe even a revolution of sorts. Hopefully a nonviolent revolution, but a significant change nevertheless. And it seems to be popping up in a lot of popular culture right now as a theme. And this is a theme of the new Star Wars movie, where you've got this Luke Skywalker character who I could identify with as this cranky guy who's kind of like shutting out the world and has given up on optimism and just like, okay, I'm done because the system is broken and he can't impact the system, but there's a need. There's this younger generation that's saying, no, help, let me learn from you, Luke Skywalker. Give me hope. And the hope comes through re-embracing the principles of individualism. I guess not really individualism, because it's also connection. There was that real strong connection in there in the movie with Kylo Ray and with Kylo and Ray being connected, other people seeking connection, and it just seemed like a call to rebellion. I'm just gonna say it. I thought that the movie, the second time I saw it, really was, we have to destroy the sacred cow nature of Star Wars so that you can actually see the essence of it. It's a story about rebellion. And if you look around you in the world today, we're kind of living in an empire-like setting in some ways. And if you're really going to be inspired by Star Wars, let that be the spark that ignites the fire of rebellion. That was a line that they said a couple of times in the movie. And then the very last scene, you've got that little kid who's, you know, the kids are showing each other the Luke Skywalker. They're playing with their own homemade action figures and telling the story, and it's going to spark their rebellion. And I think, I'm guessing that that's what Rian Johnson's Star Wars trilogy that he's been greenlit for is going to be more about. It's going to be more about how anybody can be a force wielder. Anybody can join the rebellion. Anybody can be powerful. It's a call to everyone. You don't have to be of a specific lineage or privileged or whatever, like the Skywalker family is. So anyway, I have to repent of my earlier Star Wars rant. That was my bad. And anyway, I think in this sense, Star Wars can become a unifying mythology that says there are certain values that we need to fight for. And if we need to have some kind of a revolution, or we need to fight against some kind of a tyranny, once we recognize it, we have to band together and do it. So, crazy, crazy stuff, right? Anyway, that's all I've got for today in this weird Easter egg at the end of 2017. As Infants on Thrones is having all these weird episodes where Matt believes in Jesus now, right? What do you think about Matt talking about Jesus? And we're talking about religion being a good thing. Anyway, looking forward very much to 2018 and more episodes of Infants on Thrones. Thank you all for listening. Have a very happy new year. And if you feel so inclined, please come and support us on Patreon. It makes a difference. And thank you very much. More again soon.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.